of a divisive topic. People seem to love him or hate him with not a lot in between. How kitfic is defined, however, seems to vary a lot. Some people would call anything with a kid in it a kidfic. Some people say the story has to revolve around the kid, but we can all agree that the story has to contain a kid in some way, obvs. And for writers, that means writing kids. Side note really quickly that if there's any artists that want to come on the pod and talk about drawing kids, we would love to talk to you.
We're going to talk about a few things in this segment: how kids talk, how kids think and act, and how to write parents. First up, how kids talk. I highly recommend doing a little research if you're writing a kid and you don't have one to base this on. When it comes to mirroring a unique voice like this, you might find that you're someone who does better with facts, or maybe you're someone who does better with examples. The best way to get examples is actually YouTube. There are lots of channels about child development and a lot of mommy blog style channels where people just have videos of their kids and they'll say exactly how old they are in the description, sometimes down to the week. If your fictional kid is 4 years old, just Google video 4-year-old talking and just watch a few hits. It's good to get sort of a broad example because it will vary from kid to kid, and somewhere in there you'll find the right voice for your kid and it will help get your head in the right place. From a fact perspective, if that means more to you, it's also pretty easy to find charts that let you know which milestones your fake kid should be hitting and when. Thankfully for us, as writers and researchers, it's a question almost every real parent has at some point, so the information is readily available. There's also an entire field of linguistic study called child language acquisition that investigates how kids learn and develop language. The topmost things you should be aware of are the sound acquisition chart, the rate of vocabulary acquisition, and the rate of syntactic development. The sound chart lets you know at which age a kid develops the ability to say certain sounds. For instance, a 2-year-old is likely to say, "I like this," instead of "I like this," because they don't have the dental fricative th for the this or the lateral l for like yet. We're not going to dive deeply into whether or not you should write out what your kid characters say phonetically or not. That's a stylistic choice that's between you and your god. But even if you don't write everything out or even anything out, those differences between adult and child speech will change how your kid relates to the adults around them. It'll affect how well they're understood and how they see the world. And they can even be used as plot points if there's a misunderstanding between what a child said and what an adult thinks they said.
Next up, we're going to talk about vocabulary acquisition. A kid's first word is generally a really big deal to the people who love them, but it very much goes beyond that. Most kids pick up their first word around 1 and have about 50 words by 2. Their vocab is largely governed by the life they lead, and they'll repeat the words they hear the most. Mama, dada, milk, cookie, juice, no, yes. A lot of no if you're every kid I've ever nannied. a set of animals from books, characters from TV shows. We get a lot of Dora. You hear that word a lot from kids who watch a lot of Dora the Explorer. Relative words like aunt, uncle, nana are common in the first 50. If your fictional 2-year-old is talking, think about what words that they would have heard enough to acquire instead of just what words they would have been exposed to. It's not a kid hears a thing once and then speaks. Even if Tony has an eidetic memory, child brains need to hear things in repetition. So he can't speak in full sentences at 2. Just don't do it. The older they get, the more likely it is that they'll parrot back a word that they've heard just once. This is a wonderful running gag. But also keep in mind that kids comprehend before they produce. So they'll generally understand, do you want more juice, before they can even say juice. So this is a good reminder that in general, production doesn't equal intelligence or comprehension. Kids frequently get frustrated and upset when it's assumed that they don't understand something simply because they can't say it. They also generally react badly when their mispronounced words are echoed back to them. It sounds to them like mocking, even though they wouldn't know that word. In their underlying representation, i.e. the way the word is formed in their mind, they know it's like and not wike, but they can't make their mouth make that sound yet. So mocking a kid for saying wike and not knowing what they mean when they say something is a surefire way to get on their bad side. You can use this in your stories. It's a really quick way to show to demonstrate a shorthand of a character who understands children versus somebody who doesn't. That's a really quick shorthand. By age two, kids will start combining sets of two words into little sentences like me up more juice. These syntactic changes can be the places where poorly written kids show the worst, to be honest. A three-year-old won't be talking in complete sentences with adverbial phrases and embedded clauses, but a five-year-old doesn't say me up. Kids under five are practically changing every day where it comes to language. And even after five, you'll see changes all the way into teenhood and beyond. And I'll remind you here of all the other conversations that Ferret and I have had about language and how it moves and the function it serves in society. 10-year-olds talk differently today than they did when I was 10. And so that is kind of a thing too. If you're writing a 1990s fic or a 1960s fic, you know this innately, but just be especially careful of it with kids. This means that in order to write kids accurately, you do have to be precise about where you're drawing these examples from and what your research is telling you. Language plasticity declines around 12 years old. So before that, kids are language sponges and they're picking up everything they hear and turning it into data. This is a huge trope in most storytelling, especially when adults curse in front of a child. And the differences that different families have and what profanity means, and Mrs. So-and-so said this word and my mommy hates it, because that's a lot of, they gather every piece of linguistic data they can to try to help them make sense of their own world. That's just how their brains work.
We're going to link some things in the show notes, but if you're writing a kid and you want them to be accurate, your best bet is to search for information specific to their age. A lot of what we've said has been general because it changes so much. So it's out there by the barrel load. I promise you can find stuff even for the specific month that your kid is. And we'll give some broad things in the show notes and then take that as a way to guide you where to find the information that's specific for the kid that you're writing. So now we're going to pivot into talking about how kids think and act. This will affect how they interact with the other kids and adults in the story, or what their narrative voice is like if a child is your POV character. Just like with language, kids are sponges for concepts, but they don't always have the context or experience to understand what it is they're absorbing. Fundamentally, kids are extremely self-absorbed in the sense that they lack the ability to understand things outside their own experiences. It takes time and practice and coaching for them to acquire empathy or even understand the concept that other people are, in fact, other people with their own wishes, goals, and preferences that may be different from theirs. They basically see everyone else as an NPC for a while. Kids are also programmed to learn as much as possible, as fast as possible, which means they're often fueled by curiosity. This leads to things like the endless why game, where if you've ever known a kid under six, you've almost certainly played that game. And asking embarrassing questions of people like, what's that on your face? Or why is your dress inside out? When other people would politely ignore those things. Beyond language milestones, consider other milestones too. When do babies first smile? Laugh, grasp a finger, point, look where you're pointing. These are all things we might write casually without consideration, but you might actually be surprised to find that some things are earlier than you think and some are later. A finger grasp is often the very first way your baby actively interacts with you. That's a deep-seated instinct to keep primates from falling out of trees, but a laugh usually doesn't come with purpose until 3 to 5 months. From a physical perspective, consider how kids move. They lack dexterity, but they're also closer to the ground and have much less fear of falling. Under 12 is a great time to learn to do things like skating, skiing, or rollerblading because the ground is close enough that they're unlikely to hurt themselves. With really young kids, watch videos to see how they learn to walk. They're top-heavy, big heads, and little feet, and they're still learning to balance. Very young children tend to use momentum to their advantage, but that also means they do a lot of tumbling to the ground. And when kids get upset, that is a whole different ballgame. Think of it as a spectrum of emotion with dividers that split things up into specific feelings. As adults, we have a lot of dividers. We can divide upset into scared, frustrated, tired, lonely, a whole bunch of other things. But these are all things that we learned over time. Most of teenagehood is spent adding some of these dividers, which is why teens are often considered emotional and why teenagehood may have been an emotional time for you. It's a redivision, the development of emotional nuance, and that's something that young kids don't have. So a young kid knows only a few broad emotional categories, which means that upset usually lacks those definitive boundaries. They're just upset. They don't know why. Perhaps the most well-known temper tantrum is the "I'm so tired, I don't know I'm tired" meltdown, where a kid is exhausted but can't yet recognize that that's why they feel crummy. So instead, every tiny inconvenience from "it's time for a nap" to "I can't magically turn your green grapes into red grapes" becomes the absolute end of the world. There's a great meme that I think was actually turned into a book called "Reasons My Kid Is Crying," and you should check that out if you want to see some of the logical inconsistencies that kids can operate under.
Oh yeah, just today my niece started screaming, and like she's way, way younger than this. She's like 4 months, but she started screaming at my brother because my brother gave her the apples instead of the peas for lunch, and it was just screaming, blood curdling. And then the minute the peas were in her mouth, she was happy.
Yep.
Leads us to believe that she was potentially adopted because nobody in our family likes peas, but that's a difference.
Maybe she'll grow out of it.
So writing teenagers is even more complicated than writing children, to be honest, because the process of maturing is both hormonal and cultural. So responsibility can be as much how the kid was raised in that they're ready for abstract concepts like that. But developmentally, we as humans do not possess the ability to understand abstract concepts until 13 at the absolute youngest as a rule. And abstract concepts are things like doing good, emotional nuance, that there is gray areas in conversations. All of this is just impossible before you hit a very specific developmental hormonal milestone. Death is particularly hard for preteens because they're just beginning to understand the concept of abstract permanent, like a permanent something, but they can't fully live in that phase. Of course, if a child has been introduced to trauma at a really young age, which is relevant for most of the characters that most of us write, all of that is a little bit different and might not matter because trauma rewrites people's brains and it can accelerate or retard emotional development depending on the child. This would be particularly important, for instance, if you headcanon that Howard was abusive to Tony, or that you take Clint's comic storyline of having an abusive family, Bruce's abusive father, or like the Red Room for Nat. Yeah. And kind of just, if you want to play with those specifically, understand that trauma is a separate bullet point underneath all of this. So let's do some really broad brushstrokes though. Teens are often stuck between adulthood and they are craving to be adult, but they still need comfort like a child. A teenager frequently doesn't understand what's happening in their own skin or necessarily feel in control of it. It's like what Ferret was saying earlier about the dividers. But whether this was true for you in particular or not, the process of adolescence is a process of rapid hormonal change. And it's very, very normal for somebody to feel very confident in who they are and like who their friends are and everything at like 9 a.m., and then by 2 a.m. something has changed and everything has crumbled. And that doesn't mean the child is weak or that the child is dramatic. It probably means there was a hormonal imbalance at the exact wrong moment. And coping skills are something we have to learn for our emotions. They're not innate. So for instance, when we think about the MCU, in particular Marvel, this misunderstanding of your own body is one of the reasons that Peter Parker works really well as a character as a teenager specifically, because the way he has to learn to control his powers is a really good allegory for having to control his hormones. Voices change, bodies change, things feel mysterious, sexuality is a question. Menstruation, for example, is starting younger and younger. The average age in the US was in the 1990s was 14, and now it's 11, for example. And a lot of foods that we all eat have antibiotics and chemicals that adversely affect adolescent development in particular. And everyone keeps talking about the future to these kids, especially in America. You start getting asked what you want to be when you grow up when you're like two. And by the time you hit like seventh grade in the United States, it's entirely possible that you are preparing specifically for college. So you are 11 or 12 years old. And this is the same in Northern Ireland, for instance. You take an exam at 11 years old that literally sets you up if you're going to go to university or not. But it's very common these days in westernized countries for us to put insane amounts of pressure on 11 to 13 year olds to know what they want to do when they are 40. They can't grasp the future. Their bodies, their hormones, their chemistry, it literally doesn't let them. And so it's this petrifying and yet exciting thing that they don't know how to deal with. So it's everything is possible and yet nothing is possible at the same time. I know this makes you all want to go back and relive your adolescence. But maybe if you've never thought about it before, this might explain some of why it was a hellscape for you. Perhaps it was wonderful. And I always love to hear when people had positive adolescent experiences. Mine were generally not. So I love it that mine is maybe not normal. Anyway, unlike with children where the references on the internet might be really helpful, the references for teenagers might be less so. Especially because with teenagers in particular, Hollywood has really kind of fucked us all up here, because the average age of somebody playing a teenager in Hollywood is like 25. In not another teen movie, Chris Evans filmed it when he was 26. So like it doesn't, the bodies look weird. Everything looks odd. Now, TikTok, definitely your friend. YouTube, your friend. But also remember the cultural realities of teenagers are the cultural realities that affect teenagers often more than young children in terms of personality and hobbies and vocal tics and things like that. It varies a little bit more the older that people. So teenagers are now Generation Z, and there is loads of data out there also about how that generation is reacting to the world versus millennials, which are, you know, early to mid 20s to mid 30s versus Gen X, which is mid 30s to early to late 40s, those kind of broad categories. But generations are their own cultures. So if you're really looking to write a teenager, and you in particular are in your 30s right now, teenagers now don't react to things or the world the same way we did when we were younger, because the world has literally changed at least 27 times. So doing a quick Google around about some of the more common patterned reactions might be really helpful as you're thinking about it.
Lastly, I wanted to mention that because we're talking about Marvel here, you might be writing extraordinary kids. And that, of course, changes some things. If you're working with a tiny Tony, say, or a tiny Peter, you might be asking, how do I show that he's smarter than the average bear cub? You may have also heard a lot of people say that they don't like reading kid fic because of too perfect, precocious children. Well, while there's no one-size-fits-all answer, I can confidently say, don't just write them as an adult in tiny form. No matter how brilliant a child is, unless this is a physical de-aging situation where he's quite literally a tiny adult, children lack necessary experience and development that makes them different from adults, even if they're geniuses. What most people actually mean when they complain about precocious children in fic isn't that the kid is too smart, but that the kid lacks a childlike view of the world to contextualize their intelligence. A brilliant child may master long division at 4, but will still think that kissing is yucky and that Santa is real. Precocious children can show signs of genius in different ways. It's not uncommon for precocious kids to pause in development until they're actually behind their peers and then suddenly take a big leap past them and then pause again. So you might have a child who has advanced language skills, but doesn't have the emotional development to contextualize what they're understanding. A kid may start reading books well past his experience and ability to understand from an emotional perspective. Even though he can understand fundamentally what the words mean, he can't contextualize them. It's not uncommon for a child who is precocious in, say, math and science to struggle with emotional and social development and even be behind his peers in that regard. So if you're writing a brilliant kid and you're not sure how to show that they're still a kid, think about context and perspective. Show their areas of inexperience due to lack of life or restrictions from parents or a 4-foot-tall view of the world. Give them areas where they do struggle and consider that gifted kids of all ages often struggle with the very concept of struggling and prefer to avoid things they find hard because they're used to so many, quote, hard things being easy for them. Also, don't forget that some stages are pretty written in stone. Kids need developed enough eyes to read, developed enough mouths to speak, developed enough bodies to move, and developed enough brains to manage emotional complexity. And all of that just takes time. Some intelligence is learned through experience, and you can show that in your story to give your kids depth. And while we're talking about depth, my final note here is that your kids don't have to have depth. Just as no character in your fic really needs to. If all you want is a glorified bag of flour and a papoose with a smile painted on it, then go for it. But if your goal is, as a creator, is to create convincing kids with enough depth and complexity that they feel like characters and not like props, these are some things you might want to think about.
I mean, we all love glorified bags of flour. So just,
I never had to do that thing in school where you had to like have a fake baby and take care of it. That was like a classic class thing. Like some kids did eggs and some have like the complicated fake babies that actually like cry and report things back to computers and stuff. But I know that like some classes did bags of flour as their fake babies.
Yeah, I had 1 year where it was like the really fancy electronic babies and 1 year where it was bags of flour.
Nice.
So, yeah. They were really concerned with teenage pregnancy in my school.
Yeah, mine not so much.
So we're going to also, I mean, if we're going to write kid fic, right, we also are innately writing parents. And parents may seem like one of those things where it's really easy to write them because, like, you know, the kids are the challenging part. But I've found just as many descriptions of parents in fics that have made me want to head desk that we wanted to take just a couple seconds to, again, just offer some things to consider. Again, if you would like to write sentient bags of potatoes, by all means, you can ignore everything we say all the time. Really, we don't really even understand why you're listening to this. We're grateful, but like, you know, all of this is just stuff to consider as you're thinking about it. If your goal is to write a really rich, realized, emotionally complex story, here are some character beats to think of. Parents have to have the emotional development that their kids don't have yet. And that also means disagreeing, especially with each other. It's a parent's job to provide boundaries and understand the importance of things like bedtimes, nap times, food, and school. So if your kid automatically listens to the parent all the time, it's probably not super duper realistic. Just in the same way that if the parent thinks the sun completely shines out of the kid's ass all the time and is never like frustrated or aggravated by the child's decision-making, you know, may not also be the most realistic. It's normal for parents to be interns or perhaps even in the exact same conversation, amused, frustrated, delighted, aggravated, overwhelmed, completely enamored, all of that with their child's view of the world and how their child is behaving. And since Fair just talked a lot about precocious children and did a great job, keep in mind that it can be really hard to raise a genius. They struggle to maintain potentially relationships with their peers. If you don't believe me, by the way, go ahead and search on Twitter at any point in time for like gifted and talented children. There's always a thread going around of people who were raised or labeled gifted and talented when they were younger. And now that they are in their 20s, 30s, 40s, they are emotionally crippled by anxiety. they are telling a lot of tales about what life was like for them as a child. So there's that kind of data out there too. But if they struggle to maintain relationships, they may push for knowledge or context that their parents aren't really sure of yet. Like realistically, most of us learned about more about sex from our friends or porn or TV than we did from our parents. But if you're a 7-year-old kid and you don't have friends to ask about like the funny boy parts and girl parts and you ask your parent, the parent may be freaking out and doesn't really know what to do. It may also very, very quickly, their kid may surpass them in school in a certain way. And that can be very, very weird. Like my mother jokes, my mother was a professional editor for a little while. And she jokes that like, I pretty much surpassed her when I was in high school in terms of my understanding of literature and grammar and everything else. But it was more based on the way we were being taught. I have a friend who has a incredibly like Mensa statistically brilliant 10-year-old. And the last time she was able to help her with her homework, my friend's daughter was 6, and it is something my friend struggles with all the time. And not only emotionally, but financially, because they often have to find tutors or she has to spend a lot of time working with teachers or things like that to help make sure her kid has the support that she needs. Teens are also going through the stage of developing independence. So from a parent perspective, that can be really hard. Teens are pushing boundaries and discovering who they are and often are discovering who they are in opposition to their parents. A very common, you know, reality is that mothers and daughters really struggle during adolescence because the one of the primary definitions of womanhood in a girl's life is often her mother. but she's got a lot of other data around her to determine what womanhood looks like. And the same with masculinity or maleness, or, and then of course we have teenagers who are potentially transitioning, potentially trans teenagers, all of those kind of other things, and their relationship with potentially cis parents. And then you have the whole idea of teenagers leaving the nest. I don't know a whole lot of parents that actually feel like their kid is totally ready for life to leave house permanently at 17. Even if they'll tell you that they're permanently ready, they'll still up late and worried and freaking out and all those kind of other things. Becoming an adult is a process that we treat as something like it's a fixed point in time, but it's actually an elongated process. I, for instance, am still not fully an adult, but I have been legally one for many years and living on my own. But if there's still a funny smell in my garbage disposal and I don't know what to do about it, I still call my dad. Like, it's kind of, adulthood is an evolutionary process, and parents often struggle with that evolution as much as their kids do. The process of becoming, by the way, friends with your kids is something a lot of parents of adult children talk about. And there's lots of articles and things like that. How do you transition from being a disciplinarian to being a sounding board to being a friend? What does that look like? All of that could be really fascinating, especially if you're writing a college fic. So one of the most important things that I would say to remember when you're writing a parent fic, again, if you care about being realistic, you might not hit fast forward, is that parents all the time are terrified, overwhelmed, or confused at given times, especially depending on the age of their child. Parenting in teens means a lot of conversations that may seem really mundane, but having Steve and Tony debate where Peter is going to go to preschool is a completely normal kind of conversation, and could that eats quite a lot of words if you're writing for an event with a word count and a deadline, and it's not like I'm speaking from experience.
No way, it's definitely not.
Definitely not.
Neither of us have ever stretched, ever.
I have never just created a scene because I needed 5,000 more words. Ever. It's super normal for parents to miss their friends and to miss going out as adults and to miss being an adult and not a parent. Tony, as a dad, can be completely besotted with his kid and really miss having time to work uninterrupted in the workshop. Nat could really love being a mom and miss the way her body used to work before she had a kid. Speaking of bodies, pregnancy is hard. Infertility is real, and not everyone wants to be a parent, regardless if they have kids or not. It's completely valid to have a fic where the characters get pregnant and it's not automatically happy. Bonding is also not immediate after birth, regardless if the kid is planned or not, adopted or not. Many birth givers struggle with postpartum depression, and many new parents struggle with fears and frustrations, also because they're not sleeping. There's also a lot of stigma and guilt around not feeling like perfect parents, or even what is a perfect parent. And something as simple as sounding as breastfeeding can be completely immersive for some parents, leading to guilt and frustration or social ostracization. If these are things you want to explore, you should. I love reading those kind of things, especially because so many of my friends have children and are exploring these kind of things in their lives. And if we like seeing ourselves in the page and in the things that we love, like we talked about last episode, this is an element of very common to my life that I like seeing on the page. You don't have to write perfect parents who are happy and adore their children all the time. If your goal is realism, adding pain, fear, or frustration, or anger, or regret are all normal adult emotions that are part of parenting. And actually, because both Farrah and I really love the complicated fics about parenting so much, we are going to explore those complicated feelings a little bit more in our next section, The Plug.